This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
One of the things that I really wanted was to talk about the Tompkins Square Choral and to talk about it both as it, you know, as it originated and then as it changed over time, and kind of the idea of the choral, the reality of different chorals, solo chorals, chorals with multiple people, and how that changed over time. But then also, what is the difference between doing a choral in person and having it recorded and having it play later on in the window of this gallery or another place? So where do they begin, the crawl?
I think you start by lowering your body and beginning to move. I think it's how we start.
Uh-huh. By becoming prone?
By becoming prone.
On the ground?
Yeah, but I think it, maybe before that you become, fed up, disgusted perhaps, or you become, it's an interesting question, like, when does one decide to give up? What does giving up mean? Does it really mean giving up? And I think that that's an interesting question. When I do group crawls with people, that's always an interesting question to sort of poke them with, you know, like, you're not just giving up, you know, you're giving up in quotes.
And when you poke them with the giving up prompt,
stabbing
them with that, how do they respond?
Oh, people have different responses. I mean, organizers, you know, for example, they want it to be more of a spectacle, you know, and they want something to happen. And it's always interesting, you know, to let them know, well, what's going to happen is people are going to do something very small in a way. In doing this small thing, something large will occur, you know, but you can't guarantee that. You can't guarantee what the result will be.
Mm-hmm. And the actual difference between somebody crawling for spectators, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, something will happen, that a crowd will form, that people will gather around to watch the crawl. The effect on observers, is that more or less important than the effect on the participants or the effect on the self?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's more important for those who observe versus those who do. I think it's for both. I mean, I've always thought it was for when I crawled. I'm still crawling. It's always for the sake of community. It's always in light of a community. Mm-hmm. And why else would you give up? I mean, part of my impetus has to do with a kind of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And this notion of sacrifice comes from maybe the notion of church, where, you watch the preacher, you know, it's always this point in the sermon where the preacher lowers himself and raises his hands. And I think it's the idea that you feel so unto yourself that you're able to do that. You're able to give up your body for that of some higher notion or some higher thing. Mm-hmm. But you do it for the sake of what? I mean, the preacher does it for the sake of the congregation. Mm-hmm. You don't just do it because you feel like it. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I just feel like giving up.
Mm-hmm. It's something that's demanded, right? That's required, that's needed in that context to take things to the next level.
Well, I know my aunt used to say, my aunt Jenny used to say, well, was it a four handkerchief sermon or, you know, a two handkerchief sermon? You know, like, uh-huh. You know, how much sweat? You know, was the body doing its thing, its necessary release? And you can measure. She would measure based on the handkerchief use for the particular sermon.
Uh-huh. And so earlier when we were talking, we discussed a little bit the idea of what one wears when one crawls. And we were talking a little bit about the recent die-ins. And I said, you know, if I was participating in a die-in, I'd be very careful about what I wore. I'd put on some raggedy jeans and an old jacket and maybe put a hat on to protect my hair from the ground, right? You know, you have to prepare to get down on the ground, right? And you said that in your crawls, people have been asked to wear their most treasured clothes,
right,
to sacrifice,
yes,
that which makes them feel most put together,
yes,
and proper and upright.
Right.
And so could you talk a little bit more about that sacrifice of the, you know, of garments, mm-hmm, of you know, material, mm-hmm, items as a part of the purpose of the crawl?
Well, it's funny that different people do have different responses to being requested to do this. And for example, working class people, you know, they have some of the strongest responses about being dirty and about losing their, possibly losing their sense of respect.
Mm-hmm.
Someone seeing them, like a coworker, seeing them doing this, you know, activity, kissing up to the white man, as someone once said, you know, and I think when you asked, when, you know, I think the reason I think I needed to do it in order to request it, I needed to lay the groundwork that I'm not afraid to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I ask you to go there, it's because I've already been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I was coming from, is that,
mm-hmm,
and so I remember when we first started doing group crawls, I realized it was a problem because people were protecting themselves from the event.
Uh-huh. Are they wearing knee pads and things like that? Or?
Yeah, which I can understand, yeah, you know, knee pads, but they would maybe, you know, dress down.
Uh-huh.
When I thought,
yeah,
you know, would be interesting, would be more of a, how do you say, more of a giving up would be to, mm-hmm, wear something of which you were fond of.
Mm-hmm.
Something that once the crawl was over, it would have the marks, you know, mm-hmm, of that event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the thing that you would hold on to.
Mm-hmm. As the remnant, as the,
yes, you know,
as the evident, well,
yeah, these
evidence
are my $150 jeans that I sort of gave up,
yeah,
of this Popel piece, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would
but
go.
But in that context, it seems to kind of give something more to it, you know. That,
well, you know, you and I could sit here, we could say that, you know, but the person with the $150 jeans, mm-hmm, are going like, fuck this. You know, it's like, who is this guy? But I don't know, I think it's like, I mean, art can have all kinds of meanings.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning I'm interested in is one where there's something at stake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something that you can, you know, that you can, that grabs you around the neck, or you grab it around the neck, and it does something to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm interested in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in whether it's storytelling that does it or whether it's some kind of physical activity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned the role that class has played, you know, in difference, in the different reactions that participants have had. You know, somebody who comes from a working class background, mm-hmm, and who has struggled to be seen as an equal in a middle class context, not wanting to relinquish, mm-hmm, that social capital,
mm-hmm,
right, that they've worked hard to get. And then the person with the $150 jeans, mm-hmm, who might have four or five other pairs in the closet, maybe not even being willing to relinquish one pair,
yeah,
you know, to sacrifice one pair.
I think that speaks, you know, and I think that speaks for the person making that decision. I mean, it's like you're doing a scene in an acting class, and, mm-hmm, what are people willing to give up, even in a protected situation like an acting class? You know, where are they willing to go?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, we're all actors in the thing called life, if I may. And, you know, and we need our masks to survive. You,
yeah,
know, you can't be everything to everyone. But someone says to you, take off that mask. And, you know, but I need it. I need this mask to get through my day, you know. And, so in a way, the piece, this particular one, is requiring someone to risk that,
mm-hmm,
mask,
mm-hmm,
the public face,
mm-hmm,
you know, for the sake of what? For the sake of maybe someone who doesn't have as much protective coloring,
mm-hmm,
no pun intended,
mm-hmm,
maybe,
mm-hmm,
intended, I don't,
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go there.
Has your
go
mask
there.
Changed over time?
Excuse me?
Has your mask changed over time, what you wear, how you present yourself when you perform?
When I perform?
The crawls,
well,
when you
performing.
Do the crawls. Well, when you do the crawls. When you get down, because, you know, from suit to Superman to, how does the choice
professor.
Of,
yeah.
To professor?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
How
the
does
check.
The, how does the choice of what to you know, what I to think, wear well, you know, to the performance.
I'm a father now, so I have to wear that mask, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting one. Mm-hmm. So there's that one.
To model the future for the
yeah,
for
you
the
have
offspring.
Little people, you know, yeah. and you know, you look at it, you know, so you have to wear a different mask.
Uh-huh. So how do you choose what to wear?
What do you mean?
Well,
every day?
No, not every day, but in the crawls, right? Mm. So how did you decide to put the suit on? Because I think of a suit as being, you know, the last thing that's going to be on the ground, right? A suit is upright, and it's about power, and it's about assuming authority. And I know when I used to teach wearing a suit, I felt very important, you know, and kind of giving up that protective suit armor, you know, to be a little bit more casual was a big decision for me at a certain point in my career. But to see you in a suit on the ground, I think is a very different thing than to see you in jeans and a t-shirt on the ground.
Well,
so it was a conscious decision.
Right? Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, I didn't grow up with male figures, you know, like parental figures who wore suits. But I did, historically, you see, Malcolm X wore a suit. And I remember reading about why those people wore suits. Mm-hmm. Like, why did King wear a suit? And why did X wear a suit? And it was to present this image of upwardness and of dignity. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that, they decided instead of overalls, or we were talking about that look, the SNCC look, SNCC look.
Yeah, in the 1960s.
Yeah, you know, instead of the leather jacket, you know, with pitchforks in the back. I'm going to wear a suit, you know, and I go, okay, you know, and so I thought that would be, you know, I mean, because, you know, the guy could be parking cars in a suit too, right? Mm-hmm. So, but in this case, he's crawling. Mm-hmm. There's something about the boundedness of a suit that I think I was, and I think that's why moving from the suit to the boundedness of the Superman costume for me was an interesting logic. Both of those costumes bound you in a certain way. Uh-huh. You know, it's funny, you see men with those little suits on, and suits don't really change that much, you know, in the terms of their look over time. Just like Superman, you know, Superman's costume, you know, it's like, it's time immemorial. Mm-hmm. It's a similar kind of boundedness, you know, holds your cojones in, you know, gives you the certain, you know, that little V look, you know, that's what you want, to feel hooked up.
Yeah, and it was always underneath Clark Kent's suit.
Indeed.
Right?
He was always like setting like a V thing going on. Yeah, he's action.
This is Under Armour, huh?
Yeah, but I think it's a boundedness, you know, that men are stuck with this, you know. I mean, it's a choice not to be stuck with it. Uh-huh. And crawling definitely ruffles your suit.
Yeah. Is there a gendered aspect then to crawling?
To crawling?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought so at the time. Yeah. It does make you more, it makes you, it's funny, it makes you, seeing a person doing that in a suit brings attention to the costume, and that you're unsuiting it. You're making it less bounded. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sort of actually loosening the threads of it, literally.
Mm-hmm. So what is it like for women to crawl?
Women do crawl. I can tell you that now.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the performance?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, my mom, you know, I mean, I grew up with a single mother. Mm-hmm. And one thing you learn is that, at least I learned, was that, you know, there's a way, you know, that you can get what you want, or you get, not what you want, but you can make things happen by not being direct, or by not being vertical, you know, and but I don't think I understood what it meant when I was very young. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you risking when you do that? And how dangerous it is to allow yourself to be prone with someone. Mm-hmm. And but my mom, you know, I mean, I would see her do these things, you know, like be gentle with someone who was an asshole. Mm-hmm. You know, why is she being gentle with this asshole? You know, it's like, because to be aggressive one-on-one with that person directly is much less effective. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking, you know, she's risking her dignity with this person. Mm-hmm. But, you know, fuck dignity. You know, I need to get the rent paid. Mm-hmm. So you have to, you know, you have to see what, I mean, she had to do that for her kids.
Yeah.
You know, she had to risk her her pseudo, well, what do you call it, her verticality, if you will. Uh-huh. I think verticality is, how do you say it? It's a costume.
Yeah. Something that we assume that we take on.
Yeah, and gravity always proves you wrong. You know, gravity always wants you to do this.
The end of the day.
Whereas people, when they come home and they close their doors and they're really who they are,
And
they allow gravity sort of, I just want to stay in this chair and not do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's who that person is, of course. But it's another mask, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of aggression, we could move over to talk about antagonism a little bit.
Be violent?
Right. Not necessarily being violent, but the perception, right? The perception that, sometimes your work is talked about as being provocative, as being antagonistic, and as trying to kind of reintroduce and wake people up and get them upset about homelessness again. You know, how do you reach into complacency, right, and bring about response through work? You know, the tag, the friendliest black artist in America.
Yes.
Right? You know, there's a doubling back and a sense of irony and almost disingenuousness with it. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk about antagonism as a... as a mode of working, or as a mode of working and, occasionally dipping into and mobilizing when it feels necessary.
I'm interested in artworks that whose form, part of their formal nature is that they are awkward or uncomfortable, and that's not necessarily their only formal feature, but where there's something unstable about the object. And the way you can sort of build that in is to go to a place of what we all own. We all own places of, the vulnerability or lack. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this place in our ownership of our humanity that's always about not having something, you know, and that's what I'm interested in, you know, that incompleteness.
Yeah. So there's, one of your quotes that blackness is a lack worth having.
It is.
How so? How does that work for you?
I think, people have probably, I forget who said this better, but that, if anything black people have to teach historically is that you have a group of people who have actually made their reputation, if you want to call it that, or made their value based on not having. And I think, blues comes from what? It comes from, field hollers. And what are field hollers? Field hollers are songs that black slaves sang to each other in the fields in order to communicate, in order to present a work rhythm. But it came out of, the enslavement. But what is it now? I mean, most of our music is based on R&B. That's based on blues. So you have, I think I'm interested in that you have this value now that is American music that came out of something that is, how do you say, it's not a classical European form. So that's of interest to me.
It comes out of the make-do, out of the trying to bring a space of communication where one isn't already, or where one isn't supposed to be. And, here thinking about the field haulers or, like, those work songs, like, from Parkman Farm, that were recorded in the early 20th century, where you have these kind of repeated rhythms that, presage a lot of contemporary music.
But it's also that monstrous body. It's like Thomas Dedi Rice, right? His seeing the slave who was carrying the horse, and he was deformed, and he thought, "Oh, minstrelsy! There it is. That's it. That's brilliant."
Yeah, and so he invents
Jim
Crow
the country.
In that moment.
And it's like, I remember reading that and going as a young person going, that's absurd. Mm-hmm. Why would this white man, who's Irish, I think he's Irish or Scott, what was he? I forget.
Scott's Irish.
Yeah, and so there you go. It's a blend.
We'll put it together.
Yes, little thing from the homeland. But he sees this black man who's deformed, and he thinks of this, you know, basically it made his career as, as a showman. And I think that's the other thing I was interested in. That's why I think I got into theater, is because theater had this way of taking the monstrous and making a value out of it. But, you know, it's, that was interesting to me. And that his clientele, the people who were interested in seeing him on stage embodying this monstrousness, saw that he was, they knew that the source was this black source, you know, by its different tropes. And they found it fascinating. Yeah. That was what was also interesting. Not that he just thought of it, is that he got is that he got a response from it that, that made it into, how would you say, a thing.
Yeah, that he could affect that transformation.
Yeah, that he sensed this in his public, and he brought this to them, and they said, yes, that is us. This monstrousness is us, yet is not us.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that we want, and that we want
to we only want it up there.
You know, there's an article in the New York Times today about Bradley Cooper on Broadway as the Elephant Man, you know, as James Merrick, and how everybody in the audience is waiting to see, you know, beautiful Bradley Cooper transform into this monstrous kind of creature, and how satisfying it is to see him twisted on stage. But in that situation, it's, you know, it's very different than one in which race is connected to the transformation, and that kind of, you know, with T.D. Rice, taking that that idea of blackness from that man in the street who is performing his own identity in the street as he goes through trying to make his way and not, you know, get into any trouble, right, in the in the 1840s. You know, taking that identity, that already performed identity, and then re-performing it on stage in order to you know, capitalize off of that desire, you know, what Eric Lott, you know, talks about in Love and Theft, right? You know, both a desire to engage the black body, to to take it, right? But then also disgust at that, right? You know, at that desire, and therefore kind of creating it as a monstrous engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something, it's funny that, you know, I think sometimes, you know, I think the criticism I got from doing Crawls was that it was monstrous and that I wasn't supposed to do it. And I wondered about that. Should I be doing this? Even while I was doing it, every 5 minutes I would go, should I be doing this? And I, you know, a teacher of mine once said, well, that's when you know you're there in that zone or you're at that space of discomfort that you're, that of your subject, and but there's something about Rice that I always I thought was interesting. That could he be a model for a black artist? You know, Thomas Dartmouth Rice, could he be a model for black performance agency? And there's something I was turning over in my head, you know, because my models are not supposed to be white, and they're not, definitely not supposed to be those of people who are responsible for you know, bigotry.
Yeah.
But in some way, you could say at that time, is it maybe appropriate to say that at that time, white folk could only inhabit the black body through the trope of minstrelsy? You know?
That there's no other...
Well, it was a way. It was a way in which one could do it without damaging oneself as a white. Mm-hmm. One could always say that, no, that's not me. It's just some nigger up there, you know. And but you know, see, take up my shit, and I'm still, see, I'm still the same. And I think it was a safe way to inhabit this monstrousness, to be able to have it and not have it.
Yeah. And so, thinking about inhabiting these other bodies, let's talk about reenactor, right? With this task put to these participants to dress up in Civil War uniforms. And then go about their daily lives. How did you conceive of the project? What brought you to that?
Well, it took a while. It always takes a while to convince someone that these things are worth doing. And I always find it interesting. You know, it's like it's not a con game per se. Even though the first time I was it was what the Washington and Lee University. Any of you Washington Lee University grads out there? But. But they called me up and they emailed me and said, we want you to do a piece. And I said, well, I have one I'm thinking about doing. And then they said, okay, let's talk about it. And so we started talking about it. And it went on for about maybe 6 or 8 months. And then things got weird. You know, the more they learned about what I wanted to do, they thought I was mocking them. And I wasn't. I wasn't. Really wasn't. I really wanted to do this piece. And I wanted them to engage in it. I wanted them to agree to look at this history through a trope of costuming. Mm-hmm. But we ran into problems. So that sort of fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. And then maybe about a year later, I got another call from Tennessee State. And Tennessee State, you know, is a HBC. Mm-hmm. So a historically black college. And it was a different kind of phone call.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and it was, and I was wondering, can I ask these black students to do this? Because it was mostly black students who went to Tennessee State. Even though Tennessee State, for those of you who are interested, is 20%, 25% white. So I thought that was interesting, too, because I was thinking, well, that'd be interesting to have a group walk in a room where majority are black, but some white students. It's an interesting energy. And ask that entire group, do you want to wear the uniform? And it was actually, we had some really great conversations, and they went for it. So I was quite delightfully surprised. And in Nashville, who wouldn't want to do a film in Nashville? It was like, that's the very site of Robert Altman's Nashville. So it was like perfect for me. Mm-hmm. But it took some time. You know, there was some stumbling. Mm-hmm. But eventually we started. But these students are great. I mean, this is one of the things you fall into. I was lucky, you know. I mean, I decided that I really wanted to do the project, so every time anyone would ask me if I wanted to do something, I'd say, yeah, I want to do this film. And eventually TSC did it. TSU did it.
How did you decide to make it 72 hours?
I wanted to make it, it was supposed to be 24 hours of cut footage. Uh-huh. But 24 hours of cut footage, for me, I would need probably 300 hours. Uh-huh. And I realized that to gather 300 hours of footage would take forever. So I decided what I would do is not think that way. Uh-huh. That you didn't have to have 24 hours for it to feel like 24 hours. Mm-hmm. That depended on editing. And I think I was afraid of editing. I was like really like trying to keep it simple. And I realized, you know, it's
what are
like,
the puppets doing in it?
Oh, they're explaining the film.
So they become the narrators?
Oh, yeah, it's a Shakespearean thing, you know.
Are they more like the chorus, or are they the...
Yeah, well, Greek, MC, but these, but more like, you know, the gravediggers and, you know, Hamlet, you know, like more like that.
And are they in uniform as well?
No, it's the horse of Robert E. Lee and his companion and former slave, Reverend Lee, who actually, after his, he stayed with Lee even after Lee freed him. Mm-hmm. There was a love. But he actually, Reverend Lee is really great. I mean, Reverend Lee, I think he started like 30 churches after he left Lee.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that ambiguity, right, about the past and about what we know and what we assume, right, that when the Confederacy falls and Robert E. Lee is no longer in charge, that maybe his enslaved, you know, servant is going to leave and then doesn't.
No.
Right? And then doesn't and chooses to stay and also is able to have a life and a career and do things. And, you know, how does history and researching history and engaging those, the problematic past, right? What kind of a role does that play in developing projects like this?
The research? Well, I'm a poetic researcher. I mean, I'm very opportunistic. I mean, the things that, there are things you have to know, and there are things that I sort of pick up along the way. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of an impressionistic researcher, if you will, you know. But the thing that struck me about Reverend Lee is his devotion to Lee. Because Lee had a problem. For example, the reason actually the Washington Lee thing was university gig was so important to me when they first offered it to me, because that was Lee's first and only job after. After
as
he
president.
Left. Yeah, after he was a general. Yeah, after he was, in quote, disgraced. He was the first president of Washington Lee University. Uh-huh. So that was like this is me.
Not a bad consolation job. Not a bad consolation job.
No. Yeah. I mean, but that didn't work out.
So it seemed like a good opportunity to bring the two.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to let that go in terms of my research, because once I had done all this, you know, work with it, that I said, no, Lee is essential to this. So everyone is dressed up to some degree to look like him. You know, the beard,
so the mustache,
and the hat.
And,
yeah, the whole thing. Yeah. And we got these really scraggly beards, you know. So there was different strategies. And there was a family we worked with who had a little baby who was, I think she was a year and a half or 2 years old, a mom and a dad. And they agreed, not the baby, the mom and the dad, to let us follow them for a couple of years while they did their family stuff. So they were sort of a center around which we pivoted. And then there was the Red Lee. We developed this character called the Red Lee. And the Red Lee would go out and just do these mischievous things. And so there were a number of central characters, but then there was a group, and we'd follow the group sometimes. So the film is sort of peripatetic, has sort of a derive kind of quality to it. You follow one, and the camera cuts and follows another one, and you pick the other one up later on. So you're following these different strands in time.
For the reenactors who are dressed like Lee, they're enacting and reenacting both a specific individual, but also a generic type. For people who don't participate in reenactments, right, it seems very generic. You know, people dress up as, you know, for Civil War reenactors, they're either Union or they're Confederate, right, and they dress up. But for many of those people who do it, they find individuals whose lives they want to revivify, right? They want to bring back into the battle, so they know where their person was born and the life that they led and what they had with them, what they would have worn, and they make sure that their clothes are sewn correctly, and they really want to connect over time with either, you know, their own ancestor or somebody that they, you know, feel some kind of relationship to, right? Some African-American reenactors want to, you know, reenact as specific, you know, soldiers from, you know, from Negro battalions, right? You know, but to have multiple reenactors doing the same person, right? Being Robert E. Lee, kind of subverts and upends that idea of reenacting specificity. You know, a specific individual. So, what was it like for the Lee reenactors to all be Lee?
I think it gave them the strength to do it. I mean, the costume gave them a certain sense of power. I mean, I think that was what I think some of the black performers realized, is that in doing this thing that they probably thought, if someone had asked them, I want you to dress up in a Confederate uniform, because the Confederate flag in the South is a very powerful emblem. And I knew I was, you know, again, I'm asking someone to do something which is, how do you say, that could risk them. And I was with these performers most of the time. We didn't have a B unit. I was with the crews all the time. But in terms of what is an ideal reenactor, I mean, I'm interested more in the asshole reenactor, you know, who just wants to sit around and drink beer and doesn't care whether the stuff is authentic or not, because there's this...
it was just there for the party, huh?
Well, there's this thing called farbing, and what it is, far be it for me to... What it is, it has to do with this, the ethics of reenacting. And the question, the fact that most reenactors do not question the authenticity of another reenactor. You just don't go there. So you, but you always have these guys who just, you're there for the party. You're not there for history. You're not there because your ancestors or anybody else's ancestors. You're there because this is what guys do. And in a way, I was sort of interested in those messier types of individuals who are inhabiting this space for perhaps not dubious reasons, maybe. You know.
With working with the actors and going through Nashville, how did the community react? The different communities that you went into when people saw these folks in uniform, in costume.
Well, I must admit.
And a film crew behind them.
I was protected. You know, I mean, we had this wonderful lady who was pregnant the second year we did it, which may have helped get sympathy for us. But Jody, and Jody was director of the gallery, TSU Gallery. And Jody was instrumental in getting this done, getting me in the university situation. And she would be very nervous all the time.
Yeah.
She was she was a good Southern girl, and she but doing this and letting me be her mask of dissension was a way for her to act out. And I realized that I was her mask. I said, well, if that's what it takes for me to get this done, I'll be her mask. Mm-hmm. But she would see how much it would cost, because people would say things to her. They wouldn't say it to me. They would always say it to Jody, and then Jody would come over, she'd be pissed off or something, or she'd be in a bad mood, she'd be cranky. And then you realize that something had happened.
Yeah.
You know, so to be honest, you know, I mean, I really have to give it to her. She sort of held up the flag of the project, you know, for us.
Yeah.
And protected us from, I mean, she was a good producer in that way. Uh-huh. That was her job, uh-huh. And she did it.
And have those moments of antagonistic reaction from observers, have those been different working in a place like Nashville, working in Tennessee, in the South, you know, than in New York City or in Chicago or in, you know, in the North?
People in the South are very polite. It's like Japan. You know, there's this veneer of politeness that will erupt. And, yeah, it will. People get in your shit. But that never happened because of Jody, I think. You don't attack a pregnant woman, even if she's like dragging a crew of 20 black people around in Confederate uniforms. You know, in Japan, it's a similar thing. You know, it's this really veneer of etiquette, and you have to know how to navigate it. And and I was like the bumbling American in Japan, but in the South, the bumbling black guy from the North or whatever. But if you have someone there to sort of navigate for you, you can be bumbling, and people will excuse you. Well, he's from elsewhere.
Yeah.
He's not from here.
Yeah.
I think that's probably how we got away with it. And our shooting schedule was very ruthless. We were out sometimes 14 hours a day. We shot maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 days, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Had we gone on for a couple of weeks, that probably would have been a different, we would have worn out our welcome. And that's what we did over two and a half years. So.
And by the end, did people know what you were doing? You know, was there the sense that, there's that film crew back that's making that reenactor film?
I don't think so, because Nashville is big enough, and we were all around the city that I don't think it was never a coalescing of these northern assholes.
Mm-hmm. The carpetbaggers.
Yeah.
Come
returning.
Down to exploit. Yeah.
Yes. And wear sheep and sheep's clothing and all that kind of thing. No.
Yeah.
So no, actually I think I was worried about, and I'm always worried when we do group crawls, when we do something like this, you know, and I have actually liability insurance for this, for these kinds of problems, like in case someone gets hurt, because you never know. You just never know.
Yeah.
Forget the aesthetics, you know, I just want to make sure someone doesn't get, you know, whatever. Because I'm responsible, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.